ea ka aha ho o kolo kolo ki e ki e hano hano ua a koa koa ho maila. This Honorable Supreme Court is now reconvened.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 16666 in the matter of the arbitration between United Public Workers and the State of Hawaii Department of Transportation. Arguing for the petitioner, Robert T. Nakatsuji, First Deputy Solicitor General. Arguing for the respondent, Jonathan E. Spiker. Argument on the merits.
All right, good afternoon. Aloha, everyone. Our proceeding today is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel. During the proceeding, should a justice have a question, they'll raise their hand virtually and I'll call upon them at the earliest opportunity. And at this point, I'll ask our attorneys to introduce themselves in the order in which they'll be arguing.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Robert Nakatsuji on behalf of the State of Hawaii, First Deputy Solicitor General.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice and Associate Justices. Jonathan Spiker here on behalf of United Public Workers.
All right, thank you, Mr. Spiker. Just to confirm, Mr. Nakatsuji, you'll have 20 minutes and a reserved 10 minutes rebuttal. Mr. Spiker, you'll have 30 minutes with a 5-minute warning before the end of your time. And you'll see a light and hear a tone at the end of your allotted time. Mr. Nakatsuji, please proceed.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Rechtenwald and Honorable Associate Justices of the Hawaii Supreme Court. I'd like to note that I'm particularly delighted to appear for the first time in front of Justice Edens. My name is Robert Nakatsuji, and I'm the First Deputy Solicitor General in the Appellate Division of the Department of the Attorney General. Also present with me at counsel's table is the Attorney General of the State of Hawaii, Claire Connors. Your Honors, I'd like to reserve 10 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Very well.
May it please the court. At first glance, this case may seem like a minor dispute over attorney's fees, but on a deeper level, this case could have a significant impact on our entire legal community and the functioning of our judicial system. Attorney General Connors is here with me today to emphasize the importance of this case. And the state has also received amicus support from all four counties and from the Civil Beat Law Center, which again emphasizes how important this case is. I'd like to note that we are not challenging the merits of this appeal. The ICA issued a merits decision in which the state prevailed. So, of course, we are happy with that decision. Furthermore, UPW did not file its own application for cert on the merits. Therefore, the only issue here today is the issue that we raised in our cert application, the attorney's fees issue. Regarding attorney's fees, we filed a request for attorney's fees and an amended request that were both denied by the ICA. In doing so, the ICA relied on a prior ICA case, Vincent versus Association of Apartment Owners. According to the ICA, Vincent limits attorney's fees awards to parties who actually paid fees to their attorneys or were legally obligated to pay them, such as by a contract or retainer agreement. The ICA's interpretation of Vincent is incorrect and an abuse of discretion for many reasons. It effectively establishes a categorical ban on attorney's fees awards for government lawyers. Government attorneys generally do not bill their client agencies for specific legal work in the same way that private attorneys bill, nor are they actually paid by their client agencies for specific legal work in the same way that private attorneys are paid. They also generally do not execute retainer agreements with their client agencies. Therefore, government attorneys will almost never be able to satisfy the ICA's interpretation of Vinson. However, nothing in the plain meaning of the statute prohibits the state or government attorneys from receiving attorney's fees. And the overwhelming weight of state and federal case law supports government attorneys receiving attorney's fees, even when rules or statutes use the word incur. State and federal cases have awarded attorney's fees to government lawyers in the past. Numerous federal cases have awarded attorney's fees to government lawyers, even though Rules 11 and 37 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure contain the word incur. And this court has held that the purpose of HRS Section 658A-25 is to discourage non-meritorious challenges, but the ICA's interpretation undermines that purpose, since the opponents of government attorneys will now have no fear of attorney's fees awards and can file non-meritorious challenges with impunity. The ICA's approach in this case is very different from what the court from what this court has done in prior cases interpreting the very same statute. In In Re Arbitration between HSTA and Department of Education, this court authorized an award of appellate attorney's fees against the state based on hourly worksheets and the prevailing hourly rate. Vinson was not applied in that case. Now, I happen to be very familiar with the HSTA case because I was the attorney for the state in that case. I appeared in front of this very court, although it was in front of Justice Pollack as a member of the court rather than Justice Edens. I lost in the HSTA case, and the state was, in fact, ordered to pay an attorney's fees award under HRS section 658A-25. But we had our day in court, and it was a fair fight, and HSTA prevailed. And I was comforted by my belief that if we were the prevailing party in the future, we could request our own attorney's fees. Consequently, when the state prevailed in the present case, I expected our attorney's fees request to be granted. Instead, it appears the ICA applied a double standard against the state. Apparently, we can be ordered to pay attorney's fees, but we cannot receive them. And that is just not fair on a basic level. Ultimately,
Suji, if yes, sir. Can you address square on the plain language issue that, you know, the ICA seemed to find determinative, the notion that the state doesn't incur attorney's fees? I mean, you're raising significant policy arguments, but what about just the plain language argument that given the relationship between the Attorney General's office and the Department of Transportation, the fees are not incurred in the sense that the statute meant?
Yes, Your Honor, I think the ICA is taking a very narrow and unreasonably narrow interpretation of the word incur. You know, if you look at Black's Law Dictionary, incur is defined as to suffer or bring on oneself a liability or expense. So the definition of incur includes suffering a liability. It's not limited to just monetary expenses. Furthermore, one can suffer an expense. The word expense can be read more broadly. In fact, one can suffer an expense in terms of expenditure of time and labor, not just money. And in fact, if you look at the Black's Law Dictionary definition of expense, it's broad. It does include expenditures of time and labor, not just money. And so in our case, you know, I think we suffered, first of all, a liability in having to defend against a non-meritorious appeal. But we also suffered an expense in terms of an expenditure of time and labor. So again, I'd ask the court, look at the definitions in Black's Law Dictionary, incur, liability, expense. And if you do that, you'll see that what I'm talking about is not unreasonable. You know,
then we have a question from Justice Edens and then Justice Wilson to follow up. Justice Edens, you got to unmute. I'm sorry.
You've quoted Black's Law for incur and liability, but what you do omit, Mr. Nakatsuji, is the definition of attorney's fees in Black's Law. And what they say there is that attorney's fee is a charge to a client for services performed for that client, such as an hourly fee or flat fee or contingent fee. It seems to me that what you're suggesting here and through your brief is that your work on this case prevented you from working on other cases. And that strikes me as a characterization as an opportunity cost rather than an attorney's fee. So can you explain to me how what you have suggested, you're taking away time on other matters, is comports with an attorney's fee?
Well, Your Honor, I'm arguing both, basically. You know, I had to spend 58.9 hours working on this particular case. And, you know, that is time that's taken away from the state. The state has lost that. And, you know, if UPW had not filed this case, I would have been able to work on other cases which were much more important. You know, this case, it was a weak case for UPW. We prevailed on all the issues in the appeal. And we really shouldn't have had to spend the time on this case. This case, I think, was very clearly non-meritorious. And, you know, at the time that I was working on this case, I was working on various other cases, which in my view were more important. And working on this case took away from that. And that's precisely the purpose of the statute, I believe. It's to deter attorneys from bringing non-meritorious challenges. And so I think this does fit in with the purpose of the statute. Now, as for attorney's fees, you can interpret attorney's fees as referring to, you know, the fees that a client pays to an attorney. But I think you can also interpret attorney's fees as being an attorney's fees award. And in this case, we're requesting attorney's fees award. And I believe that having worked and spent time and effort on this case, I think that is that creates an entitlement to an attorney's fees award under the statute. So I think, yes, an attorney's fees award can be interpreted as, you know, time that is billed, time that a client has to pay to an attorney. But I think it can also
let me ask you this. You know, you wrote in your brief that the fear of unjust enrichment only exists if the parties and their attorneys are distinct entities. And you brought that up somewhat in your opening remarks here. And, you know, because there's a sufficient legal connection between DOT and the Attorney General's office, you're suggesting there's no unjust enrichment. But here, it seems that it's likely that the actual costs to the state of your time, even accounting for things such as benefits, sick leave, vacation, is significantly less than the $325 that you feel is reasonable. And, you know, so government attorneys are compensated at one rate, and then you're seeking an award under the fee shifting statute here at a much higher rate, and essentially would pocket the difference. So doesn't your proposal give the state the windfall that it was so concerned about as far as unjust enrichment?
Your Honor, with respect, I disagree with that. First of all, the purpose of the statute is to deter attorney conduct. So it's really not about reimbursing for, you know, an exact dollar amount. It's really about deterring the attorneys on the other side. And the way you do that is with a uniform and consistent standard. And the federal cases, they all use the prevailing hourly rate standard. And so that will give you an objective and a consistent standard, which can then be used to deter attorney conduct.
Well, does the deterrent as far as a fee of $20,000, how much of a deterrent is that compared to $3,000 or $5,000? Is there much of a meaningful difference as far as the deterrence?
I think there is, Your Honor, because if you look at my salary and you use that as the basis for a calculation, it comes out to about $40 an hour. And if you look at the prevailing hourly rate, that comes out to about $325 an hour. And that's a big difference. I think UPW wouldn't be deterred by $40 an hour, but $325 an hour, I think they would be. And furthermore, Your Honor, I don't think that the state is getting any kind of windfall here because, you know, I think what tends to be forgotten is that, you know, the state actually does pay a lot of other expenses. You know, it's not just my salary that the state has lost. You know, the state also provides me an office and staff. You know, I have legal assistance, operating expenses like electricity, computers. All of those expenses are usually also factored in an attorney's fees award. So for a private firm, for instance, you know, yeah, the hourly rate that an attorney charges will cover their salary, but a lot of other stuff is in there too that covers the office expenses and the staff salary and so on. And that's how a private attorney gets to, say, a $300 hour rate. But, you know, with the state, you know, we are not including that in an hourly rate because we don't charge an hourly rate. So those costs are hidden. You don't see them, but they are being paid. The state is paying all of these things, and I think it's fair for the state to recover those too. It's just, you know, to do that, you have to charge by the prevailing hourly rate. And if you do that, those other expenses are figured in. Okay, but if you charge based on actual salary, it's artificially low. You're only covering salary. You're leaving out all the other expenses that the state pays. So I don't think it's as disparate as you think it is. I think, you know, they're roughly about the same. I think the state is not unjustly getting enriched. I think it's roughly the same. The problem here, I think.
What about Mr. Nakatsuji, you know, indigent appellate counsel, or, you know, for example, on criminal cases or family court cases, appellate counsel, the legislature has deemed a reasonable fee $90 with a cap of $5,000. What do you think of that as far as reasonable prevailing market rates?
Well, Your Honor, you know, I think we should be treated fairly. I think, you know, if across the board, that's the rate, then fine. But the problem here is that the ICA is discriminating against us. You know, the ICA is basically saying that, you know, you have to have shown that you paid, you know, the state paid you that amount of money. And we can't prove that. We can't show that. And so as a result, we're not getting any attorney's fees at all. So we're facing a double standard here.
If you're done with that, I wanted to let Justice Wilson get his question. He's been waiting very patiently.
Thank you, CJ. Mr. Nakasugi, you have been relying on the proposition that the state's entitled to fees because of being the prevailing party, and then you mentioned that a non-meritorious challenge deserves to pay attorney's fees. So I wanted to revisit that notion because in this case, it would seem that the statute provides discretion. I think we can agree with that. The court may add reasonable attorney's fees. And are you taking the position that the court must provide attorney's fees to the prevailing party, even in a case such as this, where you might say that the party raised an issue that was not deemed frivolous and also raised an issue after being successful in the arbitration decision?
Your Honor, I agree that the statute does give discretion to the court, but in this case, I think it's an abuse of discretion. I think, you know, it's an abuse of discretion if you disregard principles of law and it exceeds the bounds of reason. And I think that happened here. The ICA's interpretation of Vinson is...
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Nakasugi, but it does seem that you are focused on the proposition that there is an abuse of discretion because there has been a determination that the fees were not incurred and there has to be a more technical type of occurring. But let's consider the application of the abuse of discretion standard to the concept of considering, do we say, the totality of the circumstances, considering not only the fact that there's a prevailing party, but whether it is an issue that's non-frivolous raised on appeal, and in this case, whether we're talking about a party that had a good faith claim that was accepted during the arbitration proceeding?
Well, Your Honor, I think you have to look at really the strength of the case on the other side. I think their case was weak. I think, you know, we were entitled to attorney's fees on this because of the weakness of their case. You know, they lost on every single issue in the appeal. And on top of that, they haven't filed an application for cert. So, you know, the merits are over and done with. And I think it's conclusively established that it was a non-meritorious appeal. And I think if the court is going to award attorney's fees to prevailing parties, I think we qualify there. And I do recognize the court has discretion, but I think in this case, denying our fee request would be an abuse of discretion, particularly based on the reasoning of the ICA. You know, the ICA relied on Vinson, and Vinson just doesn't apply here. You know, Vinson involved a very unusual factual circumstance where you had multiple private parties and a complex legal relationship between those parties and the attorney. And in that very complicated situation, the Vinson court had to sort out who gets attorney's fees. But it doesn't involve government attorneys at all. And furthermore, Vinson, you know, Vinson is really about unjust enrichment. Vinson and Wigington, the case that Vinson is based on, they're all about unjust enrichment. And in our situation, in a government lawyer situation, you don't have unjust enrichment. We're part of the same entity that is getting the attorney's fees. So, you know, I think Vinson just really doesn't apply. And
Nakatsuji, Justice Nakayama, and then Justice McKenna have questions.
Mr. Nakatsuji, I understand that this case involves very large issues that have broad applications. However, I do have a question regarding your request for attorney's fees. You know, we had a case recently where your office, and I think it might have been you in particular, said that two attorneys two plaintiff's attorneys, even though they're in separate offices, because they represented the same people, they couldn't get attorney's fees for communications back and forth. And yet you have requested attorney's fees for reading emails between other AGs, I think Mr. Petrosevich and Ms. Guidry, repeatedly in your request. So how can you justify this considering arguments your office has made in other cases?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm not entirely familiar with what case you're talking about, but assuming
Kalima that, case.
Oh, okay. Okay. In any event, Your Honor, I'm not questioning the ability of the court to exercise its discretion in calculating a fee amount. Okay. If the court disagrees with my billing, then it's totally the court's discretion to reduce it.
I guess I'm just talking about the inconsistency and objecting to it from another party, but then you submit the same thing.
Well,
I know we have the discretion to take it off, but I'm asking about the inconsistencies.
Well, Your Honor, if the court disagrees with how I've billed, then that is totally fine. Those amounts that I listed were what I recorded. I was recording my time, contemporaneously, and that's what came out. So if the court disagrees with that, then the court can certainly reduce it. But I think the other question, though, is do government attorneys get attorney's fees at all? Are they entitled to attorney's fees at all?
I understand.
That's a different question than
I understand.
Well, Justice McKenna.
Yes, and that is exactly the question that I have. Mr. Nakatsuji, are you able to cite to me any cases in which a state court has allowed attorney's fee to a state government attorney, an AG, a state attorney?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, I think I attached a copy of the order to my cert application.
Okay, which case was that?
That was the Kawashima versus State case, Your Honor. We were awarded an attorney's fees award.
Kawashima versus?
Yes, Appendix D attached to my cert application.
Okay, and that was under which statute?
That was under 607-14.
I see. Okay, thank you. You also referred to the federal government federal courts allowing fees to the United States government, but there's actually a statute, right, for the United States government, 28 U.S.C. Section 2412, that allows fees to the government for cases brought by or against the United States?
Well, Your Honor, there are several statutes that are addressed in the federal cases, but I'm relying mainly on the cases that deal with Rule 11 and Rule 37. And, the government, the attorney's fees have been awarded under those rules, and those rules contain the word incurred. It looks like I'm out of time, Your Honor. So if, unless the court...
I actually had a question, Mr. Nakatsuji. What's the test that you say we should apply? It's a legal connection between the entities. I'm trying to understand exactly what the limiting principle is here of, when somebody would be liable and when somebody wouldn't be liable on the other side for services performed. Is it because you're the same state government? Is that the key factor?
Your Honor, if the court is willing to keep applying Vinson, then Vinson should be more narrowly defined as requiring a legal connection. And we satisfy that because we're part of the same entity. But the court can also just completely decide that Vinson doesn't apply. And I would argue that Vinson really doesn't apply. Vinson should be limited to its factual situation. Now, as for how to handle a government attorney's fees request, I'd ask the court to handle it by looking at the hours that we are billing and correcting it if necessary, and then multiplying it by the prevailing hourly rate. That's what is done in federal court. And I think the prevailing hourly rate standard is the correct standard. The court just has to look to see if we did the work, if we spent the hours and did the work, and are the prevailing party under the statute, then I think we should receive attorney's fees. I believe I'm out of time, so.
Thank you very much. You'll reserve the rest of your time. We'll hear from Mr. Spiker at this point.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Rechtenwald and Associate Justices. The issue before this court is a single word, the word incur, in a single statute, HRS section 658A-25C, and nothing more than that. A single word in a single statute. What the state appears to be doing is expanding the plain meaning definition of incur and expanding the ICA's ruling to include other situations in which a government entity seeks attorney's fees. And that is outside the scope of this matter and outside of this appeal. The state appears to be attempting to apply and conform HRS section 658A-25C to other statutes that have different wording, different contexts, different purposes, and many of which do not even have the word incur in the statute. Here, the state did not incur attorney's fees at the ICA. The Department of Transportation and the Attorney General are both departments under the state umbrella. They are both part of the same state budget and financing system. The Attorney General usually does not bill or invoice state agencies that it represents in court. In this matter, no retainer agreements were signed, no invoices were sent, and there was no exchange of money between the Department of Transportation and Attorney General's offices. And in fact, state agencies are never obligated to pay the Attorney General for its services and do not pay the Attorney General for its services. And the reason why we know that Attorney General, the Attorney General has an obligation at law to provide legal services for state agencies, we know that because it's in HRS section 28-1.
Okay, Mr. Spiker, we have a question from Justice Edens. Justice Edens. Oh, got the mute. Sorry about that.
I'll get it. Mr. Spiker, you know, you argue the state didn't incur attorney's fees or costs. How would you describe the work that Mr. Nakatsuji performed that went into defending the appeal?
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Nakatsuji definitely did the legal work. He spent the time, and that was part of his job duties, or I guess part of his, as a state employee, part of his job duties and state salary went to defending cases the state agencies are involved in.
What alternative verb do you think the legislature should have used other than incurred to indicate that the government should recover under 685 or 658A25?
Thank you, Your Honor. Definitely our position is that as the statute stands now, the state did not incur attorney's fees. So the statute by the legislature, not the courts, would need to be amended to include additional language, either clarification language, just showing that the state is entitled to fees for having worked on this matter. Definitely the language, the legislature would need to change the language of the statute in order to allow the state to be awarded, to incur or be awarded.
Don't you think if the legislature intended to limit fees to non-governmental parties, they would have explicitly said so?
Thank you, Your Honor. That's a great point. I believe this statute, HRS section 658, HRS chapter 658A, is modeled after the Uniform Arbitration statute. It's modeled after the Uniform, it's a Uniform Arbitration statute as well. And I believe the state legislature just adopted it nearly word for word or verbatim. I believe the Uniform Arbitration statute does not address awarding attorney's fees to government entities.
Well, you know, one purpose is as Mr. Nakatsuji has mentioned, for a fee-shifting statute such as 658-825 is to discourage non-meritorious actions or appeals in this particular case. But you seem to be advocating a construction that would make that statute toothless against opponents of the state or even companies represented by in-house counsel. So what I'm wondering is, how your position comports with what I view, it seems, as an explicit endorsement of attorney's fees for the government under the statute.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I guess HRS Chapter 658A, it's the Uniform Arbitration Act. Excuse me, that was it. We would just put forth, Your Honor, based on the wording of incur and the plain meaning definition, it just in this statute, the HRS Section 658A-25C, just in that statute, the way it's written, the way the word incur, the plain meaning definition, it just does not apply to government entities because they're not able to incur.
Back to my original question, is there any verb that you can come up with which would effectuate that intent? It seems that incurred is plain.
Thank you, Your Honor. I agree, or there would need to be verbs and words added. Maybe other statutes such as HRS 607-14, that allows government entities to recover attorney's fees. So I believe if this statute were to model itself or expand the way other statutes that allow government entities to recover attorney's fees. And as far as a specific verb or adjectives,
Mr. Spiker, Justice McKenna, if your answer is complete, we have questions from Justice McKenna and Justice Wills.
Yes, thank you. The issue here is incur. You take the position that the state did not incur fees, but how would you distinguish the cases in which this court and other courts have allowed attorney's fees, for example, to the Legal Aid Society or other public interest law firms or in-house counsel even based on statutes that say incur, even though those clients that were being represented did not actually have to pay those fees directly. You know, there weren't like separate fees, a retainer agreement or anything. And in those cases, courts have found that those entities have incurred the fees.
Thank you, Your Honor. I believe in other statutes, the statutory purpose and the exact terminology vary, and many of the statutes have additional language. And as far as we believe court cases that mention the word incur, in those instances, the courts did not have meaningful discussion about the word incur and how it applied in different cases. And it was talked about the Wigginton case. And in that case, Mr. Wigginton was represented by the Legal Aid Society, which is akin to an attorney general because they do not charge their clients attorney's fees. But in the Wigginton case, the phrase legally obligated was used in the decision, and it was held that Mr. Wigginton should not receive a windfall, but if he can show that he is legally obligated to pay the Legal Aid Society whatever he receives, then attorney's fees may be awarded. So besides the phrase legally obligated, the Wigginton decision actually never stated if Mr. Wigginton ever demonstrated that he was legally obligated to pay the Legal Aid Society of Hawaii.
All right.
And we believe that puts forth that in order to be, that supports the ICA's ruling that to be entitled to attorney's fees, a party must incur attorney's fees and be legally obligated to pay attorney's fees.
All right, Justice McKenna, any follow-up or shall I?
No, that's okay, please move on.
All right, Justice Wilson and then Justice Nakayama.
Thank you. Mr. Spiker, I was interested in your position in the event that we determine that attorney's fees could be awarded in this case. I guess it would mean that the concept of incur under certain circumstances has been met, even where there hasn't been a specific attorney fee charge to a client. So with that said, statute clearly gives discretion to determine whether attorney's fees should be awarded, whether they're reasonable or not. So could you give us your position as to whether it would be reasonable, assuming the court could award attorney's fees, whether it would be reasonable to award attorney's fees in this case, given the results below and also before the appellate court?
Thank you, Your Honor. I believe the state may have the position that UPW's appeal did not have merit, but I would quickly and respectfully disagree with that UPW's appeal was meritorious. In fact, the past practice and custom of UPW was to confirm arbitration awards, and that is allowed pursuant to HRS section 658A-22, which allows arbitration awards to be confirmed in this court. In this statute, HRS section 658A-25C, it does give the courts discretion to award attorney's fees. But in this matter, in this instance, with this statute, with these facts, based on the plain meaning language of the word incur and how the state did not bill, invoice, or exchange money, and how the Attorney General's office has a obligation legally and legal responsibility to represent state agencies free of charge, meaning they cannot accept money, we would say it would not.
I understand, yeah. Mr. Spiker, that you're saying that the definition of incurred means they cannot recover. But I was posing to you the scenario where we decide that their court would have discretion. And you mentioned that you think that the issue that was raised on appeal was meritorious and shouldn't be considered to be frivolous. And you mentioned that that's one factor. Would the court also take into consideration whether you prevailed below? By below, I mean whether you prevailed in the arbitration proceeding. Would that be considered?
Your Honor, as far as that, the arbitration proceeding, I would say that would have no, other than the argument about the merits on the appeal, I would say that would have no bearing or not play an issue as far as the attorney's fees.
The fact that you prevailed with the arbitration wouldn't be taken into consideration? Okay.
All right. Not at the appellate level, Your Honor.
Very well. Justice Nakayama, followed by Justice McKenna.
Mr. Spiker, you have argued in your brief the appeal was not frivolous. And Mr. Nakatsuji has, and you've said today, that there's been no argument that it's frivolous. What if it were frivolous? What if it were a patently frivolous appeal? And according to your argument of the plain reading of the statute, even if it were a frivolous appeal, the state could not get attorney's fees because they didn't incur it?
Thank you, Your Honor. If it was a frivolous appeal, I would say that perhaps under a different statute, yes, the state or the non-frivolous party could get attorney's fees. But as far as 658A-25C, no. But under a different statute or order by the judge, I could see attorney's fees being awarded for frivolous matters, Your Honor.
Even if it were, they weren't incurred?
Along the lines of sanctions and frivolous things, yes, Your Honor, yes.
All right, Justice McKenna.
Mr. Spiker, sometimes the state contracts out with outside law firms for its work. You are not taking the position, are you, that if the state had been represented by an outside law firm that charged the state certain fees for representing the state in this case, that the state would not be able to get attorney's fees under 658A-25C? You would concede that in that situation, the state has incurred the fees and could receive the fees, correct?
Yes, correct, Your Honor. In that situation, that instance, yes.
But you're saying because the state is not legally obligated to pay its own attorney generals, they haven't incurred the fees, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. How do you distinguish in-house counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. That's a great point. As in-house counsel is actually similar as well. And it would be on a case-by-case basis, but if there is an in-house counsel where there's no invoice, retainer agreements, or exchange of money between the in-house attorney and the company, then it would appear that under this statute at appeal, the sole statute, that attorney's fees were not incurred.
There are many cases in which in-house counsel have been awarded fees under statutes that say incur. Are there not?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe, yes, Your Honor. But to differentiate those cases, I would respectfully argue it's a different statute, a different context and situation, and the statute that governed those situations or those cases contain different language. And even in some of the cases stated by the site, by the state, excuse me, involving in-house counsel, there was distinguishing features or it involved sanctions or other issues as well, Your Honor.
Right. So Mr. Spiker, just to be clear, if UPW decided to handle these matters in-house and under your position, UPW wouldn't be allowed to recover fees?
Yes, Your Honor. Assuming, yes, there's no extra payment to the attorney or no invoice to the in-house counsel. Yes, Your Honor. We would take that decision.
Doesn't that sort of ignore the purpose of the statute of deterring frivolous appeals?
Your Honor, I believe any time there's the word attorney's fees in statutes, it does not scare, but it does, something happens to the attorneys and the parties. Maybe they think twice about going through with it because it is a deterrent, or it is definitely a warning that of what lies ahead.
But again, your position seems to ignore that you know, there are multiple policies behind these kinds of provisions. You know, one is to make the person whole who brings the case, incentivize them, I guess, in certain instances, but also to deter frivolous appeals would seem to be the another purpose here, or frivolous proceedings. How can you reconcile that, or how is it that under your position that purpose isn't frustrated?
Thank you, Your Honor. As far as frivolous appeals or frivolous proceedings, I would put forth, I do believe either other statutes or rules could address those. So even if that doesn't fall in context with the statute at hand before the court, sanctions or frivolous appeals can always be addressed from the court or through other statutes or rules.
Please carry on. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to, besides the state, such as the Department of Transportation, not paying for its attorney's fees, the Attorney General's office, it must represent state agencies free of charge, and that's, it cannot accept money. And that's in HRS section 28-6 that says the Attorney General shall not receive any fee or award for its role and its services rendered in its official duty. So there was a case before this very court, In Re Hawaii State Teachers Association and the State of Hawaii Department of Education, also known as In Re HSTA. And in that court, I guess the state puts forth that this court did not require HSTA, the Hawaii State Teachers Association, to prove that it actually paid attorney's fees, and did not require HSTA to produce records, receipts, or invoices showing payment. And all that's true, but in that case, attorney's fees were awarded to HSTA, which is a private entity, not the state. And there was no question, no dispute that HSTA incurred attorney's fees and had a legal obligation to pay the private attorney that HSTA hired to represent it. So in that instance, there was no need for the court to require records and proof of a retainer agreement. And the way the Supreme Court, this court, applied the definition of incur in that case is the same way the ICA applied the definition of incur in this case.
Very well. Justice Wilson has a question. Justice Wilson. You need to be unmuted, Justice Wilson. Sorry.
Hi. Yes, Mr. Spiker, I know that you're aware of the position that was taken in the amicus brief by Civil Beat that the decision to not allow attorney's fees unless there's actually been a fee incurred would have a inhibiting effect on the practice of public interest law. And we do have Kalikini versus Yoshioka, where, you know, a nonprofit organization not charging attorney's fees was allowed to recover, and the court calculated an award. So I'm interested in, if you have a response, your response to that proposition, that there has been precedent to provide for attorney's fees where attorney's fees haven't been charged by nonprofits, and that to end that practice would be something that would be inhibiting of the part of our community that practices public interest work or does pro bono work.
Thank you, Your Honor. I did read Civil Beat's submission and believe that Civil Beat, similar to the state, was expanding the issue or taking the ICA's definition of incur in this matter under this statute and broadly applying it with a paintbrush to other situations and scenarios. And I believe that's inappropriate and dangerous. And in the Kalikini versus Yoshioka case, I believe fees were also awarded under the private attorney general doctrine. And I believe statute HRS section 607-24 also played a role in that. So I believe if we're solely focused on this uniform HRS 658A-25C statute and just the word incur in this statute, in this instance, it does not harm or affect other situations or other statutes where attorney's fees are awarded to government entities or private public interest groups or the like.
Well, why wouldn't it? I mean, I see Justice Edens has a question. We'll turn to that in a moment. But why wouldn't our opinion here potentially have impacts beyond the narrow confines of this particular statute? If we adopt a sweeping version of incur, why wouldn't it have the potential impacts on public interest law firms that Justice Wilson asked you about?
Thank you, Your Honor. That we would put forth the position that since it's a sole statute and a sole situation, that it definition under this case would not be applicable to other situations arising under different statutes or different contexts.
Right. Justice Edens.
Mr. Spiker, Mr. Nakatsuji referenced in his brief and also in his remarks earlier that, you know, we have certain provisions under the Hawaii Rules of Civil Procedure, specifically Rules 11, 26, and 37, that do provide for, you know, fee shifting in fairly narrow circumstances. So with that in mind, are there really that many circumstances where the ICA's definition of incurred would prevent public interest lawyers or in-house lawyers from recouping their fees? You know, especially given that regardless of how we rule today, the American rule is still going to be in effect, and each party is still going to be footing their own attorney's fees. Are there really that many fee-shifting statutes using incurred that would impact public interest lawyers?
I believe this would be the only one, Your Honor. This is the only one that we're aware of, this statute, HRS section 658A-25C, that limits.
So when you make the comment that this is really narrow to the Arbitration Act here, I think what you're saying, or what I'm hearing you saying, is that it's not going to have the widespread detrimental impact that the government suggests it will, simply because the definition of incurred is really narrow, and it wouldn't apply in many of these situations. In other words, the public interest law firms or in-house counsel, in many circumstances, depending on the fee shifting statute, would be able to recoup or not. And I would say not, for the most part, under the American rule. Would you agree with that? I imagine you would, so thank you.
Absolutely, thank you, Your Honor. Yes, yes, yes.
Well, thank you.
Mr. Spiker, the Civil Beat Law Center's amicus brief said that the term incurred appears over 50 times in various attorney's fee statutes. So it seems like it's out there in a lot of different contexts. And what would your answer be under UIPA, which is a particular statute that they cite? How would that be distinguishable?
Thank you, Your Honor. I have their brief in front of me. I did see that they put incurred over 50 statutes or 50 results. Interestingly, when Civil Beat Law Center takes a case, they're the ones always suing the government or going after a state agency. So they're arguing, I guess, well first the UIPA, UPA, the HRS Chapter 92F, I believe, a different statute. But when it's Civil Beat involved, they're usually always the ones going after the government, and then they're seeking their attorney's fees in the end. And I do agree that the word incurred is a somewhat common word, and it appears in various statutes, but we would put forth each statute is different and unique. And when you take the statute and the circumstances of the case and read them together, in our case, it would not allow the state, or the state does not incur attorney's fees.
Okay, so UIPA, if the complainant prevails in an action brought under the section, the court shall assess against the agency reasonable attorney's fees and all other expenses reasonably incurred in the litigation. So the phrase reasonably incurred appears there. Why wouldn't the rule that you're suggesting here apply in that context? Is it because the word shall appears, or is there something else?
Thank you, Your Honor. We would just put forth, Your Honor, the different wording of the statutes, the terminology and the purpose vary, and that would prevent, in this instance, attorney's fees from being awarded.
Very well. If you have about a couple of minutes left, if you want to wrap up at this time, unless there are other questions.
So in closing, I'd like to briefly address the state's second point on appeal, which is that it should be awarded its fees at the hourly rate of $3.25 an hour. The state did not bill, invoice, or pay itself at all. And that very point that the state is claiming an hourly rate of $3.25 highlights and is precisely why incur means incur, and the plain meaning of incur as defined in Black's Law Dictionary and used in the ICA is the correct and appropriate way to apply incur in this manner. Defining incur in any other way under this statute creates a major problem and gives the AG or the state, gives them a windfall. Even if attorney's fees were awarded in the range of $40 to $50 an hour, which is the supposed salary of the deputy attorney general handling this matter, that assumes that the attorney handling the matter worked 2,080 hours a year, and it may or may not take into account other job benefits and perks. So regardless of what hourly fee is used, the end result is problematic because the state is entitled to a windfall and an unprovable amount of attorney's fees.
Oh, Justice Edens has a follow-up question. Justice Edens. Oh, got the mute.
why wouldn't your hourly rate calculation encompass the other benefits of the Deputy Attorney General, such as sick leave and vacation?
Thank you, Your Honor. I guess the point that was trying to be made is that an hourly rate can't, for a government attorney, can't really be calculated because there are factors, sick leave, vacation, benefits. Do you count office space? Do you count secretary fees? Whereas a private attorney's hourly salary, it accounts for secretary work, overhead, and things like that. Whereas a public attorney, government attorney, it's unclear and it cannot be calculated in that matter. So then
Mr. Nakatsuji says you calculated the prevailing market rate since you're unable to do that.
And we would argue in response, Your Honor, that would create a windfall and an unprovable amount awarded to the state.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you. So the red light is going. I just thank you, Your Honors, and Justices. And we ask that this court affirm the ICA's ruling that the state did not incur appellate attorney's fees. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Spiker. Appreciate it. Mr. Nakatsuji, your rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. In regard to the windfall argument, it's really UPW that's getting a windfall here if the court follows the ICA's interpretation, because UPW will get either no fee at all or an extremely low fee just because they're going up against the government. Whereas if they're up against a private firm, they'd have to pay the prevailing hourly rate. So it's really a windfall. And it's not fair for the private parties that go up against UPW, because they're getting the full prevailing hourly rate, but just because they're going up against the government, they're getting a break, and that's not fair.
Justice McKenna has a question, Mr. Nakatsuji.
Mr. Nakatsuji, if this court were to rule that Attorney General's office does incur fees under this statute, what relief would you be requesting?
Your Honor, we'd be requesting that the fees of government lawyers be calculated the same way that the fees of other lawyers are calculated. You look at the hours that we spent and then multiply it by the prevailing hourly rate.
I should have been clearer. Are you suggesting? See, the statute does say, the ICA never actually reached the merits, because they said you're not entitled. Oh, no, they said you're entitled, but you didn't incur. So if we were to say that you did incur, the statute still says that the court may add reasonable attorney's fees. And it's discretionary. It's different from Kawashima, which was the assumption statute. I actually took a look at it. And it says, in cases of assumption, the prevailing party shall be awarded attorney's fees. So this is a may be awarded reasonable attorney's fees. The ICA never actually addressed the discretionary issue. So are you suggesting that this court, are you saying that we should remand to the ICA, or are you asking this court to rule?
Your Honor, it really depends on what the court wants to do. I think this court could look at my fee request and then, you know, how I calculated the prevailing hourly rate, how, you know, the specific hours that I billed. If this court wanted to look at that, this court could make a decision, or it could remand it to the ICA. I think it's really up to this court as to what it wants to do.
Thank you. We have follow-ups from Justice Edens and then Justice Wilson. Justice Edens.
And this is somewhat of a follow-up, Mr. Nakatsuji, to the question I asked Mr. Spiker. You know, you mentioned in your application that if we do affirm the ICA, there's going to be this sweeping detrimental effects, and you say throughout the legal community, and then you specifically mention in-house lawyers and public interest lawyers. You know, when I look at the fee-shifting statutes and I look at your brief and the three rules that you cited, it seems that it's really under only very specific circumstances. And while Civil Beat, in their helpful amicus, do cite some of these statutes, I mean, there are things such as 46P3, a tobacco products reporting statute. So it really suggests to me that really when we're talking about these fee-shifting statutes and the language incurred, that it's not going to have these potential consequences that you suggest negatively towards public interest lawyers. So tell me how and what statutes that you would consider this impacting public interest lawyers and their ability to recoup fees with the incurred language.
Your Honor, I think wherever the word incur exists, I think there's going to be a problem. You're going to have this argument. And not only that, but I think it's going to have a bad effect on the behavior of counsel, because whenever you have somebody who's up against a government lawyer or a public interest lawyer and the word incurs in that statute, I think it's going to encourage the other side not to be.
I hear you, and I understand the rationale behind it, but I just don't see when you suggest that, you know, public interest lawyers are going to be so detrimentally affected. I just don't see it, because I see this as being a relatively narrow issue under the Arbitration Act and not having these sweeping repercussions. So again, tell me how it really affects public interest lawyers.
Your Honor, respectfully, I disagree with your assumptions there. I think it will have an impact on public interest lawyers. Civil Beat very clearly sees the threat. They wouldn't have filed an amicus brief in our support if they didn't see the threat. And, you know, it is correct that Civil Beat is normally on the other side of us. And I think that's an indication of how dangerous the ICA's interpretation is.
Well, doesn't Civil Beat, if you're talking about 92F and the language that the CJ was quoting, I mean, that's automatic. That's not discretionary fees, right?
Well, Your Honor, I understand where you're coming from, but, you know, Civil Beat is really not just talking about UIPA cases, but they're also talking about, in general, public interest and pro bono attorneys. And, you know, they're making it very clear that they're worried. They look at this decision and they see a threat. And I don't blame them, because really the idea of...
Where were the public interest lawyers in the amicus?
I think Civil Beat is arguing on behalf of other public interest lawyers too. And I think the danger is that, you know, I think they're worried that, you know, the court will make it a precondition of getting attorney's fees for public interest lawyers, that they have to show that their client paid the money. And they're not going to be able to show that. I mean, the whole point of public interest law is that your clients don't have to pay you. Your clients are indigent, so they don't have to pay you. But if you make that a precondition, that makes no sense. And Your Honor,
we have questions from Justice Wilson and Justice Nakayama. Justice Wilson and Justice Nakayama.
Thank you, CJ. Mr. Nakasugi, I think you would agree, of course, that attorney's fees under 658A can be awarded from your point of view. But I would also suggest that your position would assume that prevailing parties at times will not get attorney's fees, right? That seems to be an assumption in the statute, because attorney's fees aren't mandatory, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so let's look at this case and also take into consideration the concerns expressed by the CJ and Justice Edmonds. In other words, what would prevent this court or the ICA, an appellate court, what would prevent us from considering that it's not reasonable to give $325 an hour to the AG's office because they're not having to pay that? Might be reasonable to award some fee, but not $325. And with respect to, let's say, a public interest litigant that prevails on appeal, take that into consideration, that it's a public interest litigant and therefore it is important to award them, even if the issue that they prevail upon isn't that significant. Perhaps it would be an issue that would be considered in terms of exercising discretion. But with that said, I'm not sure I see why a $20,000 award should be issued against UPW in this case, even if attorney's fees can be awarded. So if you would like to describe that. You said you don't think the appeal has much merit. Has this decision been made previously by any appellate court?
Your Honor, first of all, in regard to the idea of, you know, not paying us the prevailing hourly rate, you know, that would be discrimination in and of itself. You know, I think if other attorneys are getting the prevailing hourly rate and this court arbitrarily reduces it, that would be discrimination against us because we're government lawyers. You know, ultimately, it's the taxpayers who are behind us, and it's the taxpayers who are ultimately going to suffer for disparate treatment. And I think it's just not fair to the taxpayers.
Well, I mean, that's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it is when we do this work, public interest work, we're not expecting to get $325 an hour. And why not take that into consideration? I mean, the mere fact that in every case you're not getting paid the same as a partner in a law firm, it doesn't seem to me by itself constitutes discrimination against the attorney doing the work.
Well, Your Honor, let me address your other question as to this particular case, why the court should exercise its discretion in giving us fees. You know, if you look at the merits of the case, you know, the issue that was raised below was the issue of whether UPW could get confirmation of intermediate decisions. And that issue was thoroughly rejected by the circuit court, you know, and it was based on a prior decision of the ICA. So, you know, there was already case law on that issue, but UPW still raised it in the circuit court and on appeal. So it was a really weak issue because there was already case law. Furthermore, numerous circuit courts had already addressed this issue. Numerous circuit courts had said, you can't confirm an intermediate decision. You have to wait until a final arbitration award. Numerous circuit courts, and they still proceeded with this. So, you know, if you look at the merits, yeah, look at what was really at issue, and you'll see that their arguments that they were contesting were very weak. Now, the ultimate confirmation of the award, we didn't contest because we were okay with confirming the final award. It's these other issues that UPW was arguing and ultimately took up on appeal that we were contesting. And we had very strong arguments on those issues. You know, look at the decision on the merits, look at the pleadings on the merits, and you'll see that their arguments were weak. And so under those circumstances, you know, I think an attorney's fees award is warranted. Now,
Mr. Nakas, we're well over our time. I want to let you answer the question, but I also want to turn to Justice Nakayama. So anything further for Justice Wilson?
No, Your Honor.
All right. Justice Nakayama, your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Mr. Nakatsuji, in addressing the question of whether or not the ICA exercised its discretion, in its order granting and denying your request, it specifically said the state is entitled to an award of attorney's fees. So they've already made the decision that you're entitled to attorney's fees. However, they're saying they don't agree that you incurred it. Now, you have only filed your cert regarding the terminology incurred and also the amount. So actually, whether the ICA erred in its determination that you're entitled to it, it isn't really before us. Nobody's contesting that, right?
Well, you know, I would agree that we're entitled to attorney's fees.
So. No, I know. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. That nobody's saying that you're not entitled to it. You didn't file a cert on that. UPW didn't file a cert on that. So nobody is contesting that the ICA or saying that the ICA erred, abused its discretion in determining that you are already entitled to the fees according to the statute, right?
Yes, Your Honor, I think we are entitled. And in regard to the word incurred, you know, I think that word will come back to haunt us. I think that word, it appears in so many different places. And I think circuit courts will look at that. And, you know, I think when it comes time for circuit courts to handle Rule 11, Rule 26, Rule 37 issues, I think the attorneys are going to take out this court's interpretation of incurred. And then we're gonna have really a lot of difficulty in maintaining discipline in circuit courtrooms.
Very well. Anything further at this point, Mr. Nakatsuji, to re- Oh, Justice Edens, I'm sorry. Please go ahead.
You know, and I'm sorry, my apologies as well. You know, Mr. Nakatsuji, you just brought up rules 11 and 37 again. And you know, aren't those really just sanctions motions and motions to compel issues?
Your Honor, yes, that's where they appear. Although Rule 11, I think, covers things more broadly.
So it seems limited. Would you agree?
You know, Your Honor, I think it'll come up whenever there's a discovery dispute. I think whenever an attorney does something that is really contentious, something that is really not quite proper. I think this
okay. You know, and I think there's the distinction. Is it somewhat narrow compared to the sweeping idea that you have? And I'll just leave with that. If you want to respond there, please do. But I'm done. Thank you, CJ.
Your Honor, in conclusion, I just want to respectfully request that this court reject the ICA's interpretation of Vinson, grant our request for fees or remand it, and state what I'd like the court to do is state very clearly, though, that government attorneys can receive attorney's fees awards and that attorney's fees awards to government attorneys should be calculated the ordinary way based on the prevailing hourly rate. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Spiker. Mr. Nakatsuji, the court will take this matter under advisement.
Ua ho'o ku'u ia mai ne kea aha ho'o kolo kolo ki ki hano hano okomoku aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.